Hi, everyone. Welcome to Design Development, brought to you by H&O Structural Engineering. This is your hub to learn direct from top performers in real estate development, design, and construction. I'm your host, Renz Hayes, co-founder of H&O, lifelong learner, and I'm obsessed with high-powered organizations and the leaders that guide them. If this is your first time listening, welcome. And if you're a returning listener, I can't thank you enough. Let's go. In today's episode of Design Development, we welcome Kirsten Brown. She is the principal and president of the North Star Project and Real Estate Services, located here in Greater Boston. They've been around for about 15 years. They provide services of project management, development management, and advisory services to multiple market sectors. Kirsten's a great leader. We take a walk through her experience and her growth through her career until now becoming president most recently. We learn about her experience at Spalding and Sly. She got exposed to evaluating land in the development process of Fan Pier in Seaport. And something I admire about North Star that we really focus on in this conversation is their emphasis of BD training, business development training for everyone in their company. People come in, they have monthly meetings, they have training on what are the things you can do even early in your career that are going to contribute to your ability to drive business later on in your career. This is an episode you're not going to want to miss. Kirsten has a ton of wisdom to share with you. And without further ado, let's get to my conversation with Kirsten Brown. Please join me in welcoming Kirsten Brown. Kirsten, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
I'm really excited to hear more about your journey today and learn more about North Star. For those that don't know you, could you give us a brief intro to yourself and North Star?
Certainly. So North Star is a privately held consultant firm that has been in business for 13 years. We offer project management, development management, and advisory services. I am one of the principals there. I have been with the firm since basically its founding 13 years ago. And before that, I was at JLL, Spalding and Sly. I have a degree in finance as well as a master's in real estate development.
Very cool. And about how large is your team?
We are 50 total.
50 total people? It's a good sized company in 13 years. That's tremendous growth. So I congratulate everyone on the team. What market sectors does your team focus on?
So the whole team focuses on, so this is interesting, right? So there's been a lot of conversations at our firm about sectors and then business lines and how a lot of us in the industry overlap them. So for sectors, we are in corporate, higher ed, institutional, and investor and not-for-profit. So is what do they do? Right. So we focus a lot of time in financial services, life science, residential. We've just started to get a beachhead in healthcare. And we also do a fair amount in mission critical and SCIFs.
Very nice. And so you mentioned business lines within those market sectors. So if I think about your team, do you work in teams, groups of people with subject matter experts? Do people cross paths, cross teams between markets? How do you guys organize?
We are definitely subject matter experts, and we work in teams that cross lines. So there is not every principal has a team of people that work specifically for them on just one product type. You could work at our firm and be working for 2 to 3 different principals at a time on different projects, and it is very flat and very collaborative.
And for those that don't know, I wanted to congratulate you. Kirsten was recently promoted to president of North Star. So that's super exciting. Wanted to congratulate you on that. How do you expect your day-to-day to change as you move from principal to the president role?
Well, I don't really expect it to change that much. So a little bit about the way that we manage the firm as a small firm and an entrepreneurial firm. And as a startup 13 years ago, we didn't have the dollars for the overhead. And to this day, we really still don't have a lot of overhead. So each principal takes a piece of the management of the firm. So one of my business partners is the CFO, another is the head of human resources, another is, you know, the IT. Pre being president, I was the head of marketing and business development. We manage as a team of 7. We get in a room, we manage as 1. So today, the president duties, if you will take over what the marketing and business development duties took for time. And my day-to-day really won't change significantly. Some of the things I'm working on will be different, but the day-to-day isn't going to be entirely different.
And so when I hear that, you essentially have principals, they're still acting as principals
in the service area of the business, but then certain principals take on, say, C-suite level responsibilities, and you guys kind of have that separate hat that you put on.
Correct. And we all still manage a portfolio of work that is 100% of our utilization. So you manage your portfolio of work, you manage a piece of the business, and you are also responsible for business development.
And are those principals into the actual project delivery and the service work? Are they overseeing a team and coaching a team? How do you think of a principal's involvement in actually delivering a book of work?
Very involved. We all started as project junkies, and that hasn't changed.
I like that term, project junkies.
Yeah, we're project junkies, and it hasn't changed at all. And we do believe one of the differentiators of North Star is you always get a principal on your project. We never sell a team of less than two, right? So every project has at least two people on it. One of them is a principal, and that principal is really working. They're not just oversight. They're in the details. We're more heavily involved in the upfront than we are probably in the execution, but we're still there, and we're there throughout the entire process and working.
Very nice. And I hear you on the upfront component, right? I often think a lot of our highest and best use is in proper planning and decision-making. And those decisions often are happening early in the project, or I would say in a healthy project, they're often happening early in the project and setting it up for success. So execution can be more of an oversight thing, but principal involvement in decision-making and guidance is really important.
The gray hair matters.
The gray hair matters. I'm getting some of that going. When it comes to managing your day-to-day, so you mentioned how critical it is for principals to be involved. And in your previous role, or even still, you were head of marketing to business development. If you break up, say, your typical week, how much of your time is focused on principal level work versus the marketing and business development type stuff? And sure, there's a bridge there with principal and business development work. But if you think of like working billable hours on projects versus the overhead hours, are you 50-50? How do you break up your time?
Yeah, the pie. So the pie is more than, the 40-hour work week, if you will. A principal is working more than 40 hours. We work really hard not to overwork and oversell everybody who works with us and for us. But a principal is working 40-plus hours on pure client projects and servicing them. And the principal and the marketing and the BD and the IT and all that other stuff we do, that's the after-hour work that we do. So a principal is probably putting in 60 or more hours a week, depending on the week and depending on what we're doing.
All right. So you really are looking at that responsibility of delivering close to 40 hours of billable work. And then you look at working on the business in the after hours.
Pretty much, yes. I mean, truly with us from the beginning of when we started, it was always client first and client focused. And we were the larger corporation, and we all felt moving away from some of the corporate responsibilities and processes and taking that time and focusing them solely on your client and their business and their success was important to us.
Client success is ultimately important. If you're ever succeeding as a business and your client's not succeeding, there's a headwind in your business, right? So you have to really support. I like to say you need to align employee success, client success, and then the result is business success. You have to offer three main sectors. You break up your service offerings into three things: project management, development management, and advisory services. Could you help us explain the difference between the three?
Certainly. Probably easier to start with the development management. So in our firm, if it's development management, it's anything that's coming out of the ground. And it doesn't necessarily differentiate from when we get into the process or when we are hired that will make it development management. If it is ground up, it's development management. Project management is anything that's within something that is already built, be it first generation or second generation space. So you could think of that as your tenant improvement projects. And then advisory services is really that true consulting type of service where we would be in and helping with highest and best use of land, site selection. More recently, we have found ourselves in a lot helping with understanding a lot of the environmental requirements as people are working towards carbon neutral goals and working and providing advisory services in that manner to understand what they need to do before you get into an execution.
What's an example of a client that's coming to you for that type of service? Is it a corporation? Is it a private developer? Is it a university? What type of client?
Well, the universities pretty much have programs set up that they're working through, and we would be working with them and are working with them and helping them understand it and do the study and put the inputs in and then implement the work. An example of an investor developer is one client that I have today where we're actually going through their portfolio and doing, we're calling them market readiness assessments, where we're looking at the building and what it would need to be market ready when the tenants turn, as well as how to get it into compliance within the jurisdiction, whether it be Boston or Cambridge, that it's in. To even, you know, we're finding some of our clients are interested in having that plan of how they're going to achieve their environmental goals and then use that for the marketing as well, where they may not be in compliance today, but showing the future tenants, this is their plan to compliance and to be environmentally sustainable and to do the right thing. And it's making, and it makes a difference today with a lot of the more institutional grade tenants.
As I think about that challenge of owning an existing building that's, let's say, on its life cycle where it needs to be updated, the existing building code and the new stretch energy code requirements, the emphasis on electrifying our building, electrification of our buildings, the exterior envelope maybe getting closer to passive house, those are becoming standards in new construction, and the existing buildings are going to be expected to be brought up close to that same threshold. Is that something you're looking at during these advisory services? Because it's a risk and a reward based on like how much does it cost to actually do that for your existing building?
It is. And it's interesting, especially with everybody learning more about what does the new code and the opt-in code mean and translate to on these renovation projects. You know, when it's triggering the need for envelope improvements to meet the code. And then when you're taking your mechanical improvements and you're adding on the envelope improvements, you're getting close up to new construction dollars, if not more than new construction dollars. And is that really viable for the asset that you have? And so we are working through them. We have been working with multiple engineers trying to gain consensus. And the truth is, we're all still learning. It's going to take some time for people to go out and implement to see what's actually rational and viable, and then for it to do what it does every time the code changes, right? For the interpretations to come through and for the industry to work together as a whole on how to achieve these goals in the most intelligent way or reasonable way.
That's well said. And I think there's a learning curve going on the people putting together these codes and requirements from an energy perspective, because sometimes there's unintended consequences. Like, I think we all recognize the importance of lowering our carbon emissions. But if an existing building code just to do a tenant fit out requires us to replace the facade to get up to today's quality, like, are we really helping our environment by throwing that out and manufacturing a new facade? Or is there a better way? So I think everybody's learning on like, how do we navigate this challenge together? But there's no doubt a headwind.
We're getting smart and we're pricing it.
Yeah, because you're right. Like, if it costs more, if the replacement cost is then less than updating an existing building, that again is counterproductive to the ultimate energy goals of what we're trying to do.
Correct.
Project management, you mentioned first generation, second generation. These are our tenant fit out. So is this typically in your corporate, your life science? Who are your typical clients? Are you working for the tenant or for the landlord helping guide the tenant? How does that service work?
I believe if you were to look at our portfolio, we do more of that work for the tenant, although we have been on the owner side of it, and we bring that perspective, especially since the majority of the partners are from the development owner side of the business originally. But the majority of our work today, I believe, is from the tenant side. And it is, you know, in the last couple of years, it's been predominantly life science. We've been very well positioned to ride that wave, if you will, with the industry. We have corporate and had it in the past. There just isn't much of it out there today happening. Yeah. So those two, I think, are predominantly it. We just started to get into medical, which was in our 5-year plan that we set out 2.5 years ago, which is great for us. Yeah. The majority of it is life science and corporate.
I think of your team's role in project management services for a corporation is so critical, because they don't know what they don't know. Their expertise is in running a business, a life science business, your traditional office business, professional services. They're not builders. They're not construction people. So they don't necessarily have the awareness of investment in return, what things should cost, where to best allocate capital to get the result they need, how to build a budget. they really need guidance and somebody in their corner to help them make the decisions. And I think when done right, it also helps the design and the construction team, because you become the bridge of decision-making that helps the project move along, right?
That is correct. We've been referred in many times by the architects and construction managers who would like to have that person at the table who is operating in that role as the bridge and the communicator.
In ground-up development, when's the ideal time, or when are you typically brought into the project? Is it upon site selection? Is it pre-site selection? Is it once something is permitted, you're then there to help carry the entire project through construction? Like, what's the makeup of the development management services?
I think it all depends on the client and their expertise. We have predominantly been brought in post-site selection. We consider it fortunate when we're there for the discretionary permitting phase and the design phase, because when you're there from the beginning, there's two things that happen. That is where you can add a lot of our value. You know, it's the smaller spend and the setup of the team and the process that pays dividends, as well as you are there for all of the historical knowledge so that when you get into the implementation, you're that much more effective. A lot of people forget that once you're through your permitting process and you start construction, there is a whole process of monitoring and ensuring that you are implementing per your permitted approval. And that is in itself something that needs to be done. And you can do it without being there in the beginning, because we have done that. You're just that much more effective if you were there and experienced it to implement it.
I think being early or involved in those early conversations for any type of consultant, it's where you have an opportunity to be strategic and share your experience and perspective to help make better decisions, versus the later you get brought on, it almost starts to commoditize the service where you're just executing in a sense, right? I want to take a step back to your education. I think you did your undergrad at BU. And what did you study there?
Finance. So it was business administration with a concentration in finance.
What did you think your career was going to be in when you went to BU?
At that point in time, I definitely thought that I would be in the corporate environment world, working with numbers in some capacity. I had a math brain. I was good at math. I enjoyed the financial underwriting of deals. And that is firmly where I thought I would land.
So you already had a draw. You were already drawn towards real estate at that time.
No, interestingly, I wasn't. So it could have been a corporate deal. So in my mind, all I knew at that time was that I would be in a corporation, that I wasn't an entrepreneur, that I didn't have the makeup, that I would be in a corporation, and that it would be financial in some manner.
What was your first job out of college?
My first job out of college was at a bank called U.S. Trust that is no longer. It took less than a year to realize that I did not know what I wanted to do when I was in college. Because it wasn't a match. The best way I can explain it is you graduate, you start a job, you're in a cube, you're crunching numbers, you're in that same spot all day long, and it didn't match my personality.
There was no was there engagement with other colleagues or people, or it was literally you and the numbers?
There was engagement with colleagues and other departments, but it was mostly you and the numbers and doing that job. So it just didn't fit my personality. If you spend any time with me, you know, I prefer to talk to you than do my work.
I'm the same way.
Yeah, but there's a little bit of that happens. And so in that first year, I did a lot of soul searching, if you will, and thinking back to my upbringing and my education and what I found interesting. And out of all of it, and I'm spending a lot of time thinking about the education and the finance, came to the conclusion that my favorite class was my real estate finance class. And that what I really liked was real estate. So, and I also graduated in a very poor time for real estate. So I graduated in 91. So lots of foreclosures, lots of distressed real estate. And I've now decided that real estate is something that I'm interested in and would like to do for a living. So I had the opportunity. U.S. Trust was a little different than other banks, where instead of selling their notes on 10 cents for the dollar, they were actually taking back the real estate, and they formed a real estate owned department.
Oh, wow. So people that had debt with them started to default on the property. Instead of selling that off to clear the note, they just created a trust and just took control of those properties because they own.
So they let them go to foreclosure. No, and if they weren't purchased, they buy them back and bring them into this portfolio.
And so you got to move there. This is in like your second year of your professional career. You move over to the U.S. Trust, it was called. They form this alliance. So did you see this through for a few years? How did this whole process work out? What did you learn?
I did. I learned a lot. I stayed with it through to the end. So I was in that group for 5 years, 6 years. If I can do the math correctly, our job, it was interesting because our job was to work ourselves out of a job. But it was an unbelievable education to get at that time where we were foreclosing on all real estate types and bringing them into a portfolio where we had to manage them and reposition them to the best that we could to get the highest value that we could given the current market.
I mean, time is their friend there, right? Like you said, it was inopportune time, maybe in a lot of cases for people that were starting to default on real estate, but that also creates opportunity for others. So I think in hindsight, I would think they seized an opportunity to create a new entity and see a return on that property over 5 years.
Yeah, to the best that they could, right? They still probably never got back what they had out as an original note, just given the height of the late 80s. But instead of getting 10 cents on the dollar, they got 60 or 70 cents on the dollar.
Do you have visibility into what allowed that bank to have the stability to do that? I think in a lot of cases, banks during those volatile economic times sometimes are also at risk. So they have a cost of inaction, or sometimes they have to move on from something to try to stabilize their bank. What did they have a unique position in the market? How are they able to just absorb that hit short term for 5 years during what I'm sure is a challenging banking time?
Yeah. As the entry level person, I'm sure that I could tell you exactly how the balance sheet looked that allowed that. I can tell you the differentiator of them versus, say, the regional or the national is they were a smaller local owned bank. The president at the time, Jack Seidel, his name, had a lot of control over the bank. And so it had to have been in a financial place where it was allowed to do that within that lane. And that, the only thing I can think of today, looking back on it without actually knowing, sitting there at that time of it happening, is the fact that it was a smaller bank.
Yeah. And they were able to make that decision themselves and have kind of control of the strategy. So they were able to weigh their pros and cons.
Correct. And they were able to handle it a little more entrepreneurial than otherwise.
You ended up going back to MIT to get a master's in real estate development. Obviously, you just had this pretty cool opportunity to reposition underperforming assets or assets that were underwater over 5 years. What made you want to go back to get a master's degree instead of keep working in the industry?
Well, so I was working myself out of a job and I enjoyed it tremendously. The management of different asset classes and the transactional, the disposition of them and doing a deal, really enjoyed it. But as you're coming out of that and you're in your late 20s and the market is starting to change, your opportunities seemed more limited on what you could do. And what I wanted was this opportunity to do more, if that makes sense. So two things happened, and it sounds a little silly, but I took a continuing ed class at MIT, probably in that fifth or sixth year. And I came out of it and I'm like, I want to go back to school. Like, that was amazing. That stretched my brain in a way that it hasn't been stretched in a while. I get to think big picture instead of in this narrow lane of which I'm now very good at. And I had cookies. I had cookies at 3. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is I can remember saying this to people and then saying, Kirsten, if you go back to school, you don't get cookies at 3. Like, that's not why you go. And I'm like, well, I know that's not why you go. But it just, there was this moment of it's bigger and there's more out there. I also had a real benefit of meeting one of my first mentors in that job, and not a mentor where it's manufactured, but the organic ones that just happen. And she too suggested strongly that I consider this. And so it was that moment of a class that made you think you can think bigger. It was the privilege of having an organic mentor who saw untapped potential in me that could be more and urged and supported me to do it. And then I did it. And I only applied to one.
And you only applied to one. I love that kind of confidence. And I think there's something to be said. You took a course and found yourself excited about it. I think any individual, we learn the most when we're absolutely like invested and interested in the topic we're trying to learn on. I think sometimes the thing that gets lost on us in education throughout high school and even college, when we don't know it quite exactly what we're going to do, it's hard to stay engaged for 4 years of learning something if you don't know how you're going to apply it. You now had real life experience and went back to a real estate program knowing you loved real estate, seeing the opportunity, someone you trusted and a mentor gave you the advice, and you went back and were excited to be in that environment again. And again, it was in a time that maybe there weren't an abundance of jobs in the economy, and you were able to free yourself from the day-to-day stress to submerge yourself in this experience where you could learn and think big and kind of figure out that next step. So I think there's a lot of value there.
There is. And you nailed it on the, you're back doing it with experience and you're interested. The difference between grad school and undergrad is night and day. You're surrounded by people who are all interested in the same thing. They're all invested and they all want to learn and succeed. That creates a completely different environment than undergrad.
Quick break from the show. Thanks for tuning in to Design Development. We're trying to help as many people as possible. So if you could subscribe and leave a review on today's episode on whatever platform you're listening, it would be a great help. It's the only way we're going to reach more people. Let's get back to the show. Coming out of undergrad, I was considering an MBA, and there was all the people that said you really need to go get real life work experience. At the time, I was like, I don't need real work life experience. I'll go figure it out and I'll go learn in the program. It's not to say that you couldn't get through the program and have some takeaways. It's just the benefits of going through a program with work life experience are exponentially greater than without them. And I now see that as I kind of replaced the MBA, or I replaced the additional education by like investing in my own learning. It's part of why we launched Design Development. It's audiobooks, podcasts, talking to mentors and other people that have walked the path before you. It's the same thing. I'm trying to solve business problems and work within my career while also educating myself. And the feedback loop between the two allows me to grow at a much faster rate.
There's no right way. I also believe you should be able to jump out of the workforce every 5 to 7 years and go back to school, but I only did it once.
I did it once every 5 to 7 years. I don't think there's anyone stopping you. It's just a financial investment.
There's something about sabbaticals.
Take us to Spalding and Sly. How did you end up there?
So I ended up there graduating from MIT and out on the loop, and probably one of the best times out interviewing with everyone and learning more about the real estate field in Boston than ever before. I had a classmate whose father was a principal at Spalding and Sly, and I met him at our graduation. He was like, you need to come in and talk to us. And I'm like, okay, I'll come in and talk to you. I'll talk to everybody.
No problem. Right.
And when I graduated, I really thought that I would be on the flip side of DISP and I would get a job in acquisitions and be on that side of using my financial background, underwriting deals, and be on the acquiring side of them. And so when I went in to talk to them, he had me speak with the group in capital markets where I would have been a broker. And then he also had me come in and speak with his group, which was development. And now I don't have a technical background. I was finance development, not an architect or an engineer. And I went in and met with everyone. And I had one principal say that he probably thought I would be great, but didn't have the time to train me and, you know, probably couldn't do it. And so what I heard was no. And then that made me want it.
And that made you want it more. And this was on the development side or the capital markets?
On the development side.
Development side,
so
yep.
The capital side, at the time, you know, I'm of the opinion, we can all go back in time, but I'm in the opinion that they would have hired me. I had the right skill. We got along. I had the personality.
I'm sure you would have been a great hire. There's no doubt.
No doubt. Yeah. But I had one say, well, what I heard was no. I'm not going to say he definitively said no, but I heard no. And after a lot of conversations with the gentleman who brought me in, he just kept saying, you just need to be intelligent enough to get the information from the experts and to formulate and be able to make a decision and a recommendation and keep moving the process forward and be task-oriented. I was like, well, I can do that. I want to say that I interviewed for 8 months. I probably went in 15 to 20 times to the point that the receptionist actually thought that I worked there.
Wow.
They kept interviewing me.
8 months, 15 to 20 times?
It was and I could be exaggerating with age, but it was a lot.
That is a rigorous interview process.
It was. Well, so I was different, right? I didn't fit the mold perfectly. I didn't fit their mold perfectly. I fit Heinz Development's mold with the business degree, and maybe even then I didn't fit theirs perfectly either. They did more of the Harvard, you know, business school versus the MIT, right? And then I was finally hired by Kyle Warwick, to work on the fan PR project and to help him with the cost underwriting and managing all of the books, if you will, for that development that they were in the process of permitting. And that's how I got my foot in the door, was through my finance.
Amazing.
And the ability to do that, and then learned, you know, then they eventually hired me, and then learned while I went. So a little like you, right? I learned while I went, and I was with a group of people that, again, I didn't fit perfectly with, because the majority of them, and the same with my firm, we hire people, we prefer the people with the technical background. So I'm not a perfect peg in that hole.
There's a lot of takeaways there. One being, you leveraged your past experience to find a way to drive results and contribute to organizational success while you built the other competencies to fill in your skill deficit. I think that's a perspective honestly, anybody switching companies, there's something you don't know about that company and how they operate the day you step in. So you're going to find, like, how am I going to use my current skills and experience to create value while I figure the rest of this business out, right? Especially for entry level. The second one is the grit and resourcefulness to chase a job that you didn't necessarily have the resume to support getting there, right? It takes grit and resourcefulness. But I think for anyone that's being told no, that you...
Or stubborn.
Yep, that's another way to put it. For those chasing those types of opportunities or feeling like you're on the precipice of no, I think sometimes the thing that can push you over the hurdle for somebody to take a bet on you is when you show the grit to respond to that no and to explain why and how. Like, what attributes do you have that commitment to success, commitment to succeeding over all hurdles and obstacles? Because that in itself is like one of the highest level predictive success. Are you willing to be resourceful and figure out how to get a job done despite having never done it before? You want that person on your team, right?
You do, because you can train them.
Spalding and Sly, FanPeer. Can you take the audience through what is the state? FanPeer is a prominent development in Boston Seaport. For those unfamiliar, could you walk us through the state of Seaport at the time that you're starting to look at the FanPeer development?
It was a surface parking lot on the fan of the old railroad ties. Anthony's Pier 4 was still standing at the tip of the Pier 4. The courthouse was in construction, starting construction, wasn't there yet. I can't quite remember. Was there for a long time. Actually, looking back at the timing of all of this, and I was hired in late 98, early 99 to help with putting together the cost books and the pro formas for the fan pier. Took 3 to 4 years to go through the process of the discretionary permits and to get those approvals. And then when you actually sent to me the fan pier in its sale in 2005, I was like, oh my, I lost a couple of years in there. But there were a couple of years in there of trying to get the deal, you know, trying to get that first one to go at a certain time in the market after we had gotten through the approvals. So when all was said and done, I had worked with the team on the Pier 4 and had evolved my role in it as well, from not just the cost perspective, but helping with the design and the entitlement process and having the ability to have a seat at the table and to learn all of those skills as well, that it was 98 to 2005 and two babies, and then it was sold.
7 years, two babies, a lot of life changes to get to that. So
yeah, and so it taught me a couple of things. It taught me, which was very interesting and hard at first, I came from a very transactional background where we were celebrating deals. And there was a high to that. Every time you closed, you celebrated. And we had multiples per quarter and a lot at the end of the year to development, which you needed to learn has a long duration and milestones within it that you need to celebrate. And then the fan pier where we never even, I never got to put a shovel on the ground. you had to find the mini successes. And, you know, so my takeaway from this one was my big success was when it ended up transacting, it transacted for the land value that we had been modeling all along. So there was some validation in that.
There's a ton of validation in that, because that's a challenging property. And to kind of to set the stage, FanPeer, if I'm not mistaken, is really one of the first large scale private developments in Seaport. Despite its proximity to Boston, I think the interesting piece of Seaport, like you said, there's a lot of surface parking, old mill buildings. And that part of Boston, despite being a 5 to 15 minute walk from Boston South Station in the financial district, used to be cut off by the elevated highway, right? Before they did the big dig, and the big dig kind of dropped everything underground and made it more accessible to the center of Boston. And Fan Pier was really the first development to break ground over there and kind of set off what we now know is like a 20-year bull run on pretty high-end real estate development in Seaport. I think to be able to underwrite that first deal and beyond with your projections is something absolutely to be proud of, because that wasn't, you didn't have any comps for that property. There's no comps, right?
There were no comps. It was a good testament of what Spalding and Sly was and the full service that firm that it was and all of the expertise that they were able to pull on, right? So it was Spalding and Sly brokers that were giving you the data for the market for the rental rates. It was construction helping with pricing, right? So there was just a large group of industry experts all feeding into the variables, because it really is just all variables and input to get to the output.
Take us through the time when Spalding and Sly was acquired by JLL. What did that lead to?
That led to a little transformation in the market for sure. So at least as it relates to, you know, the project and development management. So Spalding and Sly was a regional firm, about 300 people working there. And a lot of us who worked there for a reason, a family, more of the family owned feeling, the regional real estate perspective. And then they sold to JLL, which is a good thing, or can be a good thing. It was a great thing for the owners. And it could be a very good thing for a lot of people there who wanted that platform, right? They have a service. They're very good at it. They provide it. There were some of us, though, that didn't want that platform, or were at a point in our lives where that wasn't what we were interested in. So, for example, me, the opportunity to go anywhere in the United States and have a global or a regional or whatever portfolio wasn't that appealing to me. I joined that company because I wanted to work in the Boston market. I firmly believe I need to be within my real estate to be successful. And I didn't want to travel or move a small family. And so as we went to go through a downturn, or as we went through a downturn, JLL, very different than Spalding and Sly, and because of how it was owned, right, a publicly traded company versus a private company, started to let people go. And so what we all started to experience for the first time is, if there wasn't income against your name, then you were going to probably be let go. Where, having gone through a downturn with Spalding and Sly, they were not unintelligent business people, and they would take the opportunity to do the necessary cleaning that needed to be done in a downturn. But they then would hold on to talent, and they would have the divisions that were doing well support the divisions that potentially were hurting the most in that economy, so that they would come out the other side stronger. And so as we went through this downturn and we started to let go of some really good development talent because they didn't have income against their name at that point in time, because we discussed development as a long game, we started to come out of the downturn. And I would, as we came out of the downturn, those of us who were still there questioned, you know, did we win? Like, are we really winners? We made it. We're coming out of the downturn, but is this what we want? And so the first, I would argue that the first wave of people that were let go, that were, you know, the true development talent and good talent, all went out, and they all each individually hung a shingle, if you will, and started to do some work within their lane of expertise. Then they co-resided, and then they decided to join forces and name themselves, and that was Redgate. And then there were those of us who were still there, who kind of questioned the, did we really win? Decided we didn't win for us, and we left in 2010 and started North Star.
Exciting. So one business transaction led to two pretty prominent local Boston businesses. So that's a pretty cool result, and a really good story to expose people to. And it's not to say there's any one business model that's better than the other. They're just different. There's different decisions, and there's a right and a wrong place for individuals. You got to align the values and the future goals of the people that work there and the company that they're supporting. And if those aren't aligned, there's going to be a friction there. Again, doesn't mean right or wrong, just means different. And you got to find a place that's best for you.
Correct.
Take us to the early days of North Star. So I think you mentioned 13 years. This is 2010. You joined very shortly after it was initially founded. Take us through the early days, the first few big wins. When did you guys really feel like you built momentum?
I even think back to the early days. Predominantly Harvard University. was
a good client.
Very good client.
Yeah, a lot of real estate.
A lot of real estate. So I'm going to say out of all of the partners, and we all were very ethical, because the one thing you have in a service business is just your reputation. And so our departure to the start of our firm, there was never a crossing of the line of a pre-empting, if you will, with clients that we were leaving. It was we left, and then came the dialing for dollars. And I believe probably the first really big win is that the majority of our clients all came with us.
They ultimately followed you.
They ultimately followed. And that was an enormous win. And our first one.
Yeah, it speaks a lot to the value that you were able to bring them.
Correct. So that to me is the first win. And we didn't get them all, but we were in the 90% of them, I'm going to say, that did come with us. Even me, who left 5 months later, my clients came with me.
And how many partners are there in the early days?
There were four when it was first founded, and then I was the fifth.
Four founders, and then you were the fifth, and that's within 5 months. So real alignment. And was this a conversation for you throughout those 5 months?
Yes.
So it was very much like top of mind, and you're kind of wrestling, what's the best direction for me at this time?
Very much so.
Thank you for sharing that. You mentioned heading up marketing and business development. Those are two areas I also love to talk about. And perhaps one of the most impressive things, or the things that I've come to love and appreciate about North Star, is your emphasis on business development training throughout the organization. Could you tell us like how your perspective on business development, and tell us about how you infuse that throughout your entire organization?
So to the beginning of time when we started, and I had called us Project Junkies, all of the principals at North Star are Project Junkies. None of us really were the big sales income producers in our prior careers. And we started and we realized we needed to feed this enterprise that we had created, and we needed to find a way to do it that felt right to us. And so we did. We started to figure that out as us and how we were going to do it. And we realized as we were doing that and bringing on employees who were working for us, that we felt it was very important to bring them along the process with us from the very beginning, that to not give somebody the foundation and let them learn the long game, because it's not a short game, that you're only doing them a disservice if they get to a certain point in their career. And with us, it's, you know, going from the PM levels to the VP levels, that you need to be in a position where you're bringing in business as well. And to just say to somebody by the time they say get to a senior project manager, that now to get to the next level, you need to bring in sales, and you never gave them the tools or the foundation to be successful, then you put them at a disservice and in a place where that they can't see.
What a powerful perspective, because as you say that, I would say it's more prominent or more common that most people, when they get to a position of expected to create business development or drive sales, they haven't really been exposed to how to do that or how to think about it. And unless they're taking the initiative to ask the questions, to read the books, to learn, to go out and talk to people, they're not going to be there. But like you said, if you give people the perspective of the long game, business development at its core, at its center, is building relationships.
Correct.
And the sooner you start learning how to build relationships and put yourself in a position to build relationships with industry peers, the better off you are long term.
It's building the relationships. It's creating a brand. It's creating your own personal brand while you are also elevating and enforcing the company brand.
Do you have training specific for business development? How do you map this out to get, say, younger, early professionals exposed to business development?
We start from the day you're hired. You could be a project coordinator. From the day you're hired, you're handed a company credit card. You're encouraged to go out and network and to have coffee with industry peers. You're also encouraged to join an industry organization, as well as to attend at least 9 events a year to just get out there. And that's the start, right? So the start is you can have the credit card, you can go for the coffee, you can attend the events. That's kind of your first level. The next level is for it to start to really have value, and for you to create those relationships that we just discussed, you need to take it to the next step where you join and you align with one of the organizations that is interesting to you, and you put yourself on a committee or in a program where you're going to create relationships and bonds with other people because you're working towards something. You're not really doing that just attending events. That's the stepping stone to get to the next level. So that's for their own, that's what we're doing and we're encouraging for the individual to help with their own growth and their brand. And then every month we have a business development meeting in which everybody attends. And in that meeting, we will go through, or back to the old days, of we will go through all pursuits of what is the company pursuing, what have we won, what have we lost, so that everybody has an understanding, as well as what's out there in the market. Because it isn't just what you're chasing, it's understanding everything that's happening in the market, because those conversations and information can be useful to others within the market. Because again, it's helping others, right? And having that connection. That's the piece that's interesting, is the market is starting to go through, dare I call it, a correction. And we're starting to go a little bit back to our roots of how we do this. I had a lot of newer people in the firm somewhat confused by, why are we doing this? And so we paused for a second and we had one of our business development meetings where we talked about, why are we doing this? And this is why. We don't expect the new person to come in with a deal, right, and an opportunity. But if they take the time and they're building the relationships and they're building a brand, that when they get to that level in their career where they do need to be doing that, it's going to be easy because they've created the foundation.
I love that. I absolutely love that. The team-wide business development meeting every month, that's something I'm actually probably going to implement now at H&O, because it's just exposing people to all these different conversations, which gives us all better awareness and context to what's going on in the market. And like you said, somebody else over here might have a tip that helps you in a relationship and connect the dots for a client and create value. So I applaud North Star for recognizing this need and implementing it into their day-to-day business. One quick question I wanted to ask: how do you manage different personalities in the business development program? Like you said, you're implementing this from day one and encouraging people to build relationships in the industry. What about the introvert versus, it's probably easy for the extrovert to want to buy in and go out and do this. What about the introvert that doesn't necessarily want to? How do you manage that or put them in a position to succeed?
Well, so there's more than one way to succeed, right? And you don't need to be out shaking somebody's hand 9 times or 12 times a year to do that and to start it. What I have said to the people in my firm that are introverts or have that feeling is, lean into your projects, lean into networking with your project team, create your relationships there, start to create that network. And then from there, find the people that you truly align with and you can see yourself having a relationship with and carry that relationship on and get together, find a like group of people who are at the same level as you, and go out once every 2 months and talk about what's happening in the market and what you're seeing and create your brand and your network that way. And it will come if you do that. But you have to at least do that. You can't be a complete true introvert and never put yourself out there to generate a relationship and a bond. But if you lean into where you're comfortable within your environment, and especially on large projects, the opportunities are enormous. Like the teams on a large project you have at least 100 consultants by the time you're all said and done of 100 opportunities to create relationships.
Great advice. North Star has also shown an emphasis in succession planning and an emphasis of strategic planning. And something I've learned to recognize in businesses, all businesses either transition ownership or they die. There's only two options. They can't live on forever, so they either got to move on to a different ownership or they die. Your team seems to have understood that and has been bringing up the next level of leadership. How are you investing in this next level of leadership? You're bringing on more shareholders. Talk to us about this process and why it's so important.
Because as you said, right, it's a sale or it's a cession internally. And there's a real desire, to the extent that next generation wants it, we work to make it available for them. And to date, there has been an interest. I can't tell you I have it solved. I have, after you and I have talked, I've listened to all your podcasts that have the other people on talking about succession planning. And I know I'm not the only one that doesn't have it figured out in its entirety.
There's no silver bullet.
There is no silver bullet. There isn't. And the only way to do it is to start, right? And so we started. And we have started with identifying a shareholder status that can work themselves towards principal. I would argue if you were to ask me, what are we going to be working on the next couple of years? It's going to be just that. It's going to be a lot of internal work and growth within the organization, not external. It's going to be continuing to elevate and teach, if you will, the next generation how to be at the table, to be doing it. And I would argue at the same time, learning from them, right? Because the more that you empower them, the more they're actually teaching you with the excitement and the knowledge of ways to improve and to continue to stay kind of on the cutting edge of what you're trying to do and to deliver.
That message correlates to the lesson you learned in business development training throughout your team too. It's right. Your team all of a sudden like, why are we doing this? And there's an education process and you get that feedback loop when you start to expose people like the second level of leadership into what ownership transition looks like and what organizational growth. And you guys mentioned you've built an extremely successful business over the last 13, 14 years. And to see that continue, it really requires investing in people. And you guys are doing that at a world-class level. I love to see it. As we wrap up today's conversation, something we try to get from every guest to share with the audience is your top book or podcast that you would recommend.
Out of all of this, that's the one that killed me the most in preparation.
Oh, no.
Honestly. So I went back and I was looking at all of the books I've read. And I'm like, well, which one is the book, right? Which one's that bullet? And there isn't, right? There is little nuggets that you take from every book you've read that starts to build you, right? So what I can do is share the one that's most current and I think relevant to my today, because it's the one I happen to be reading now, which is The 5 a.m. Club by Robin Sharma. Here we go. I'm going to be pronunciation. Is that correct, Ethan?
Sounds good to me. 5 a.m. Club.
It's The 5 a.m. Club. And what I like about it coming out of COVID and the pandemic and the way people worked, and some of us worked where we lost, I don't know, have very great boundaries to begin with, but I lost all boundaries where I was working 10, 11 hours a day, right? In and out and not with a rhythm, where this starts to help you stack your day correctly. It teaches you the importance of the early morning, which people who know me know that that's not my favorite time of day, but the importance of it and getting some things done early, then stacking the day and kind of organizing it in a way for success. And so since January 1st, I've been getting up at 5 a.m. and I've been working out in the morning.
That's the time to get it in.
It's a lovely book. That's a good message.
I can certainly support the message behind it. I'll have to check out the book by Robin. I haven't read that one. I am a longtime 5 a.m. club person, though. I find that there's so much that's happening throughout the day, whether it's your team, your business, your clients, your family. People are always they need you at all parts of the day. So if you have the few things that you need to get done, that's for you to make you the best self to serve all those people. To me, between the hours of 5 and 6 are the time that I can get that done. So that's when I invest in myself so that I can be there for everything else the rest of the day.
You're already there.
That's the idea, right?
Yeah, it is.
Kirsten, thank you so much for joining Design Development. We're trying to share the stories of leaders like you so people can see parallels, find their next step, and advance their own career. I wish nothing but the best to you and everyone at North Star. Thanks again for being a part of Design Development.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for tuning into Design Development. Real quick before you leave, our goal is to help as many people as possible. We're a growing community and you're a big part of it. So just click that send button, send this episode to a friend, let them get those same insights that you got today. We appreciate you. See you next time.